All right. Well, hi, everybody. My name is Dave. I'm with Mondo Weiss, and I'm here with Michael Aria, our U.S. correspondent and the writer of the Shift Politics newsletter. It comes out every Thursday on our site. Michael tracks the BDS movement across the country, U.S. politics, kind of a broad range of stuff. You can subscribe to the Shift newsletter by visiting our website, mondoweiss.net/theshift. And we're going to just talk about a little bit about the election that's coming up in just a few days and hear what Michael's thinking about what we can expect, what's happening and what we can expect on Tuesday and beyond. So, Michael, you've been writing the Shift for us for a while. What are you expecting tomorrow? What are you expecting to happen on Tuesday?
I mean, I wouldn't want to make a prediction after 2016 and after the 2020 we've had, but I think if the polls hold up, obviously they look really good for Biden. And I would just say, I think I had mentioned this in the newsletter this week, where I kind of did an election guide. But I think if Biden does hold on and win, we're kind of entering a different. He's entering a much different political moment than someone like Obama was entering. And I know, you know, there's been speculation that maybe this potential Biden administration would just be kind of a retread of the Obama years. But you know, it's interesting. Like when Obama won in 2008. This might be difficult to remember, but there was a lot of hope, no pun intended, among liberals, but also among segments of the left, especially when it came to foreign policy, because, of course, his big, disagreement with Hillary Clinton during that primary was her support for the Iraq war. But then, of course, after he was elected, he appointed her Secretary of State, and that kind of set the tone for the next 8 years in terms of foreign policy. I mean, I probably don't have to go through his track record on here. I'm sure everybody watching knows it. But I think we're in a much different situation now when we look at, speaking beyond Palestine, when we kind of look at the left, right? Because we've seen kind of the climate change movement grow and become more aggressive. You know, we just saw Ed Markey beat back the Kennedy dynasty for the first time ever in Massachusetts as a result of, you know, young environmental activists kind of getting involved with that campaign. We've seen the country gripped for the entire year after the police killing of George Floyd. There was no squad. There was no, you know, this kind of movement of progressives or leftists and socialists even joining city councils locally or progressive DAs. So I think the left is in a better spot than it was in 2008. And I also think that, you know, another big story of the Obama era is really the deterioration of the anti-war movement that kind of flourished under the Bush administration. And a lot of that excitement, protests, you know, millions of people on the street, was kind of swallowed up by excitement for Obama. And despite the fact that, you know, we put 34,000 more troops or whatever it was in Afghanistan, never shut down Gitmo, bombed Libya, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a little different too. I think the Trump administration has activated kind of a lot of people, has you know, drawn a lot of people towards activism. Of course, there's going to be some people who are kind of, you know, once the Republican loses, will kind of stop paying attention. But I would just say that the disappointment with Biden is the optimistic view, I think, would be that it could somewhat be a strength because, you know, it's almost like as soon as Obama was elected, a lot of people were continually kind of making excuses for his more conservative moves, whether it was domestically or foreign policy wise. And I know like everybody I know who's voting for Joe Biden is not a fan of Joe Biden's politics. So I think it's a much different situation than it was. And even like in terms of what I cover, you know, like the BDS movement was really in its infancy when Obama was elected. The awareness of the movement has grown so much when we look at polling as a result partially of the crackdowns on BDS that we've seen under the Trump administration, and you know, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar being barred from entering Israel by Benjamin Netanyahu, ostensibly being requested to do that from Trump by many reports, And, you know, we didn't see it. Like, we have Betty McCollum's bill in the House, which we cover a lot, which has, I think, you know, a couple dozen sponsors. This is a bill to kind of cut off U.S. funding for the detention of Palestinian children in Israel. She had another bill a few months ago aimed at cutting off U.S. funding for any potential annexation plans that the Netanyahu government might move forward with. We have Ilhan Omar's bill protecting the right to boycott countries based on their human rights policy. So, you know, Biden's obviously not going to save us. I don't think anybody watching this thinks he's going to save us. I don't think anybody thinks he's going to be great on the question of Palestine. And I mean, I probably don't have to run through his record, but I'll just, you know, quickly say extremely pro-Israel voting record. He's, you know, bragged about his 40 plus year friendship with Netanyahu. He's self-declared Zionist. He's against conditioning aid to Israel in any way. Says he's against annexation and settlement expansion, but also, you know, calls conditioning aid or, you know, lessening military aid to Israel outrageous. Calls it a gigantic mistake. It was interesting when they did these task forces, which was an interesting term, I thought, because they were actually tasked with doing nothing and they seemingly had no force. But there was, you know, they did a lot for domestic policies, environmental, you know, like AOC and people like this were put on these that the Biden team kind of made up, I think, a kind of overture to the left. But, you know, they didn't even have a foreign policy one, which is kind of like they're not even pretending that the foreign policy is going to be anything other than, you know, what it's been for, you know, the last however 50, 60 years in this country. Interventionist and extremely pro-Israel. So, you know, that's kind of interesting to me. So I don't think we're going to get anything from Biden, but I would just say that, like anything else, I think the mass movements and the organizing and the activism around these issues is only going to increase. And I think we're seeing a fracturing of the consensus regarding Israel, certainly among the American people. And this is something that I put in the newsletter quite often, but when we look at polling of something like conditioning aid, for instance, the vast majority of Democratic voters support it. You know, if you ask them, do you want to cut off aid to countries with human rights abuses? The vast majority of Democratic voters say that they do. And there was a poll that we wrote about, I think it came out the end of last year. It was done by University of Maryland, which asked Democratic voters if they had ever heard of the BDS movement. And I want to say it was something like 50% of them had, and 48% of that 50% said that they at least somewhat supported the BDS movement. And these are mainstream Democratic voters. I mean, this is, you know, it's also worth pointing out that we're coming off of two presidential campaigns from Bernie Sanders, who, you know, like it's interesting. The country, our political system, economically speaking, has moved so far to the right over the last 40 years that, you know, somebody like Bernie is, policies are regarded by the mainstream media and by establishment Democrats and by Republicans as extremists. But when we look at exit polls after, you know, this last primary, even states that voted for Biden, they, you know, the vast majority of Democratic voters supported Medicare for All. They supported the Green New Deal. So we have ample evidence that Bernie's agenda is quite popular. And what's interesting is Bernie's agenda is really not that much different from like a New Deal Democrat would have been, you know, like 50 years ago or whatever. The difference is that, you know, mainstream Democrats kind of occupy the space now that Republicans used to, and the Republican Party now has gone like so far to the extreme. But you know, compared to that, I think Bernie did seem radical to people because we've moved so far to the right. And I think the same can be said about Palestine. I don't think that Bernie is like some savior when it comes to Palestine. I think if people, you know, search his name in our archive, we'll see many critical articles about not just his position on Palestine, but his foreign policy position throughout the years. They haven't been perfect, to say the least. But having said that, compared to the consensus, the foreign policy consensus in this country among the political establishment, his very basic common sense positions, which are embraced by the vast majority of Democratic voters, if we look at the polling, conditioning aid to Israel. You know, he spoke about bringing humanitarian aid to Gaza during one of the debates. He's, you know, repeatedly referred to Netanyahu as a racist, and that's all within the mainstream of the voters. But it, I just think that's also a very important moment insofar as, you know, he, him and AOC, the squad, and other people who talk about conditioning aid to Israel, they are acting with kind of the full support of their base. And, you know, it goes far beyond Bernie or far beyond any politician. That base is only going to increase, I think. And these positions like conditioning aid to Israel are going to be the mainstream dominant position among progressives who maybe, you know, were more right leaning when it came to foreign policy, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, or when Obama was elected. So I didn't, Biden's not going to save us, like I said, but I do think he's entering a much different political moment. And I do think there's that we have some momentum on our side when it comes to our stuff. So,
Yeah, I think that I think the question is going to be how strong, how much strength has he got left in him once he's in office? And what are people doing around him? And so I, when you look at the people that appear to be moving, like moving into the circle around him, getting ready for the transition, it's a bunch of Israel lobby folks. And I think that they may be trying to kind of buttress him because he doesn't have dementia like some people might have dreamt, but he certainly is not the Joe Biden of 2008. So.
And
it'll be interesting to see what the movement can do to push on him, how Kamala Harris, like the role that she's going to play, looking to her political future. She has certainly flirted with the lobby, but it's, I think it's still an open question just how committed she is. She's not a Cory Booker, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either. Just one quick thing I mentioned about Harris that's interesting is if there was that vote that Sanders, the House vote and Senate vote about reducing the Pentagon budget by 10%, which is, you know, like a massive no-brainer at the time of pandemic. And she was one of, I think, the only senator who ran for president. So like Klobuchar, Warren, Sanders, all the other ones voted for the cut, and she voted against it. And this was like, I want to say weeks before she was picked as VP. So it might be kind of like a signal of things to come on that level.
Yeah. So let's dip into some doomsday scenario stuff. So the day after the election, if Trump wins, presumably he's going to continue to push this deal of the century. You know, on the call that he had with the president of Sudan and Benjamin Netanyahu the other day, he's openly, you know, tipping his hat that they've got other countries lined up, Saudi Arabia. I mean, he named them during that event. That are going to come into to this normalization, what he's calling the deal. Like there's this, this one normalization deal that, that everybody is signing on to when it, that's not really what was happening at all. What do we expect from a Trump, a second Trump term when it comes to Israel-Palestine and when it comes to BDS and the kind of the assaults on free speech that we've seen from Betty DeVos and other members of his cabinet?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a little terrifying because I was reading this Politico piece the other day about about them potentially tagging these human rights groups, kind of mainstream like Amnesty International and stuff, as anti-Semitic and encouraging other governments to not work with them. And it mentioned a source in there that said that one of the reasons that Pompeo was pushing it is because he might run for president in 2024. So he's already trying to kind of curry favor with evangelicals. I think you're seeing a lot of that stuff, last minute push among that segment of the base, Christian Zionists, et cetera. We just saw today, I think they, or yesterday, they changed now on passports. You can technically say if, you know, you're from Jerusalem, it can be written as Jerusalem, as being in Israel, whereas before it did not. Yeah, I mean, more of the same. I mean, these deals are, you know, allegedly peace deals. I think if we look at them closely, they're war deals, really, right? They're arms deals. They're deals to to sell weapons. And, you know, Palestinians are once again left on the outside looking in. It does nothing, you know, to further their cause. And, you know, every day it seems like a new country is coming out of the woodwork to be celebrated at some White House function for making peace with Israel. But I think you'll see more of, you know, the same policy you've always seen from them, more extremist stuff, green lighting, you know, whatever Netanyahu wants to do effectively. Domestically, it does get, I think one of the things that we've covered a lot, but maybe the mainstream media hasn't, and it's kind of ironic because you know, we've seen a lot of ink spilled and a lot of commentary about cancel culture over the last couple of years. But, you know, one of the biggest examples of people being canceled, quote unquote, is happening on college campuses when it comes to, you know, BDS activists or pro-Palestine activists. And the Trump administration has really waged a war against the Palestine solidarity movement at universities. And the way that they've kind of done this is by using civil rights law as a cudgel. There's been this huge push. People watching probably know what the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is, but it's basically a definition of anti-Semitism, which includes some criticism of Israel. And, you know, that's been being pushed in states when it comes to education, when it comes to schools. And the reason why is because, you know, if anti-Semitism is defined in this kind of broad way, then we're seeing it already is the same way that kind of ALEC, you know, like the way that, say, the corporate movement in this country, anti-labor, anti-worker movement, you know, finds like the one person who disagrees about union dues and then kind of like bankrolls them with this huge campaign. You know, that's what happened with like the Janus ruling, for example. There's a similar thing here where if a student says, you know, I went to this anti-apartheid conference or whatever and felt threatened as a Jewish person, then ostensibly they've had the support of this administration's civil rights office to kind of launch a campaign to kind of attack that university. There was a big case in North Carolina, which we reported on quite a bit, where there was a conference with people from Duke and UNC. A Palestinian performer did a satirical song about a Palestinian falling in love with an IDF member. And this event was kind of targeted. There was a local right-wing politician who called for an investigation, and then Betsy DeVos's education department ended up doing the investigation and basically sending a note that said, you know, unless you get your, you know, program into line and under the standards that the US government, you know, deems acceptable, that we can potentially pull funding from the university, or at least some of the funds it gets. So we're seeing this again and again. And I just reported in the newsletter, I think a couple of weeks ago, at Butler University, they tried to rush forward this resolution to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and another one to condemn the BDS movement. So that will, I think, just ramp up. It's already, you know, picked up a lot of steam, and I think we can expect more of that if Trump is, you know, reelected or the Republicans are successfully able to steal it. I do think things could get really bad quick when it comes to just the crackdown on dissent, really. And this is not to say that the Democrats or BDS supporters are great on this issue, but I do think there has been an aggressiveness from the Trump administration when it comes to this, that's kind of, you know, incredible. I do think that's a story that's kind of fallen through the cracks with a lot of people.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the horse race aspect of the election. Which congressional races are you watching? What should people pay attention to Tuesday night and the next however many days? Because who knows how long this is going to take. But yeah, what races are you watching, and how did, like, what role did Israel-Palestine play in those races?
Well, I think a lot of the drama for, you know, like Palestine doesn't fact, Israel certainly factors in, but you don't see a lot of politicians or people running for office championing Palestine very often. So for us, that number of lawmakers who to pay attention to is pretty small. However, a lot of the drama has already kind of passed, because that would have been like the primary fights. If we look at, for instance, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, I mean, you know, they were allegedly vulnerable candidates. People like to believe pro-Israel money, funneled into big time into Omar's opponent's campaign. I think a couple million dollars, and you know, they all won easily. I think, you know, Cori Bush is going to win easily. She won the primary in Missouri's first district against Lacey Clay. She's said very about as supportive things about BDS as I've ever heard or seen a politician say. And, you know, she was smeared by the Clay campaign for her connection to Muslim pro-Palestine activists, for her support for BDS, for allegedly being anti-Israel. So Missouri First District, certainly. And then I'd say, of course, New York 16th, where, you know, Elliot Engel is about to be ousted, or has already been ousted, but Jamal Bowman is about to go to Congress and, you know, presumably win that one easily, which is taking place in the Bronx. Elliot Engel, of course, was one, you know, he's been there since, I think he was elected in 88, and one of the most hawkish pro-Israel Democrats. And, you know, that was a huge blow for the lobby, definitely, you know, who had spent big on Engel. And the other thing to remember about Engel is that he was the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. So now there's going to be a battle for the gavel there. Brad Sherman.
It seems like it's kind of receded into the background, which I guess makes sense. Everybody's focused on the election, but some interesting people had put their names forward. Castro. Who else was it? Was it Brad Sherman trying to get in there?
Yeah, Castro, definitely the most progressive of the bunch, has talked openly about conditioning aid to Israel. Yeah. Talked about, you know, it was actually quoted by the Jewish Insider, I think, or I think it was them, saying that he'd like to bring Palestinian voices to the committee, which is, you know, a progress of a kind, certainly compared to what usually happens. Yeah. But the Gregory Meeks is in there as a potential candidate. Brad Sherman has really staked his claim at the position on the fact that he's kind of the logical successor to Engel, and has actually appealed directly to pro-Israel groups, and basically made the case that, you know, you went to bat for Elliot Engel and you understand how important Israel is. So, you know, I think it's important also. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Just trying to think of other potential races. There's a Betty McCollum, you know, who I mentioned earlier, is expected to easily win Minnesota's fourth district. I mean, she's, you know, as I mentioned earlier, has the legislation that we pay close attention to. And let's see, I would say California's 53rd comes to mind. That's, I don't think it's going to be much drama there. It's between two Democrats, Susan Davis and, Susan Davis is retiring. She's been in the House for 20 years, and it's between Sarah Jacobs and Georgette Gomez. Gomez was initially backed by Justice Democrats, who, you know, everybody probably knows their deal. They became quite a famous organization as a result of, you know, backing AOC and other progressive candidates who won. But she gave an interview with the Jewish Insider where she kind of distanced herself and rejected their position on Israel, which is a completely like clear position. It's not like they, you know, put out some deep position paper or something, but they have referred to Israel as a human rights violator. And that was enough to kind of, I guess make her feel like she had to distance herself from that statement and also kind of play up her pro-Israel bona fides in this interview. And, you know, there's a piece of the Jewish Insider, I think this week, it's hard with time lately because everything seems like it was 5 years ago, but I think this week, about how there's a source in her campaign that says that Justice Democrats have effectively stopped fundraising for her and have all but pulled their endorsement. So that seems like a very small thing on its own, but I think it does, it's a crack, or you know, it's a potential crack in what we've been talking about in terms of this pro-Israel consensus kind of fracturing on some level. You know, it's connected to, you're gonna have Phil on one of these, but you know, kind of intellectual thought changing too among like the J Street crowd in terms of like a potential one state solution as opposed to a two state.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see that if they're serious about it, then Justice Democrats, which is easily the most effective progressive organization in terms of electoral politics, is putting down a marker.
Right.
That, you know, a pretty clear one, especially, I think, with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'd say those are all ones to pay attention to. But like I said, a lot of the drama on that level has kind of passed because, you know, all these people winning their primaries was obviously huge. Dan Lipinski also I mentioned, who lost in Illinois' third district to Newman, he was, you know, a big pro-Israel Democrat backed by AIPAC. So the lobby and, you know, pro-Israel groups have really had some massive setbacks this year. And I think, you know,
Can you think of any races where it's played a role in the opposite way, where the person staking out the Israel lobby position has really benefited? I'm wondering, like, the race between Jamie Harrison and Lindsey Graham in South Carolina for that Senate seat. I mean, part of Lindsey's DNA is that he's in lockstep with the lobby. Harrison, I think, has avoided bringing that up, really. And I know he participated in a DMFI event. Any thoughts on where Jamie Harrison might be?
Jamie Harrison, yeah, I watched that DMFI event. He was very vague with all his answers. I think that that's an interesting thing going forward. You know, progressive candidates potentially avoiding the topic of Israel. I did a piece about the Massachusetts primary, whenever that was, a couple months ago, and all the activists I spoke to told me that foreign policy hadn't really factored into any of the campaigns at all, which is partially, I think, maybe not understandable, but, you know, foreign policy gets short thrift among the media anyway during regular years. And, you know, to have a pandemic and to also have this administration where it's just kind of like a daily scandal, I think there's kind of naturally a focus on domestic issues. But I think that's another interesting thing, because we're going to see, you know, for instance, like Richie Torres, who was elected in this kind of super strange primary in New York, which people can look up the details of, but very bizarre situation. Progressive ostensibly when it comes to a lot of things, but also extremely pro-Israel, did an event, like I think days after winning, with a IDF soldier online virtual event. And kind of, you know, Richie Torres is gay, and a lot of his rhetoric about Israel kind of implements, you know, what we refer to as pink washing, a lot of stuff about, you know, Gaza is anti-homosexual, et cetera. So he's an interesting person to keep an eye on, because I do think, you know, like in New York, there's been so many big wins for the left recently, not just when it comes to congressional people being elected, but also, you know, like the local government. I think they have a couple of socialists on their city council now. DSA backed candidates. I think DSA backed 12 candidates in the city, and 11 of them won. And the one race that they lost was the Richie Torres race. But, you know, DSA even has, you know, evolved in the last few years where, you know, they certainly moved beyond like the politics of Michael Harrington. You know, they've endorsed the BDS movement by, you know, a big majority. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, to see how, you know, a very pro-Israel, progressive on other issues, but very pro-Israel, how that gets navigated, how activism there and how local lawmakers kind of go up against that, and what kind of, struggles we see there. So I would say those are all things to keep a close eye on.
Yeah. This has also been the first election cycle where we've seen movement activist groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, if not now, play more of an active role by setting up affiliated political action committees. I think this is the first election JVP, through their political action committees, endorsed anybody, and if not now, is a young organization. Right. What do you know about those groups and their political action committees and the impact they may have had on the cycle?
It's been interesting, you know, this is kind of pre-COVID when everybody was still traveling to events, but on the campaign, if not now, a lot of young people, students affiliated with that group. And also we did a story about JVP action members traveling to kind of following the candidates along the trail and, you know, confronting them about the occupation and about, you know, annexation, other policies like this. It's interesting to see those groups, you know, create forums where they can do more direct political work, where they're not kind of hamstrung by the rules of a nonprofit. You know, they can endorse candidates, they can encourage people to vote a certain way. But, you know, I think that's a huge development, because it does show that, you know, people with these kinds of politics and, you know, these kinds of activists feel like there is a forum for them you know, to an extent within DC, for lack of a better term, right? I remember interviewing Jennifer Bing, who, you know, has been there every step of the way and worked on McCollum's bill, who said that, like, you know, when a while ago, like 10 years ago, whatever, she didn't even think it was worth talking to any Congress member, really, because you didn't see any results. And you're kind of seeing that shift a little. And it's interesting to for these groups to kind of see that there's an outlet for them, or there's a place for them to show up and kind of encourage people to go a certain way. I would say that, you know, that, I don't know if it's led directly, but it's interesting to see it contrasted with kind of the modern pro-Israel groups, which have sprouted up in the last few years. Like DMFI is a group that Democratic Majority for Israel, as a group we've covered a lot, and they've taken some like huge losses. Obviously, Engel was the guy that they were trying to protect. They spent a couple $1 million trying to fend off Jamal Bowman and failed. And it's interesting. One of the way that a lot of people became aware of them is after some members of If Not Now confronted Elizabeth Warren during an event and asked her about how she planned to, end the occupation. I think some question like this. They released this big press release and basically implied that, you know, you would have thought that like Elizabeth Warren was assaulted. Like, they just like lost it. This big press release about like how candidates should respond if they're confronted by these people. And, you know, this is a organization that was created really, to stave off this growing sympathy within the party among voters for the Palestinian cause. And, you know, I think if you read between the lines there, that's exactly what they spent big money trying to stop Sanders in a lot of states during the primaries. It's also been interesting to see they, you know, a lot of, and this was a group that is comprised of donors, longtime, you know, party people connected to the Democratic Party who have worked in the party for years. And it's interesting too, like some of those
nothing about their leadership that makes young people get excited.
Exactly. And I would just point out that, you know, I remember when they ran those Sanders ads, it was like a lot of the ads had no connection to Israel, even though they were bankrolling them. Yeah. And that is also an interesting development that like they know on some level, I get emails from them sometimes because I'm on their mailing lists. And, you know, whenever a pro-Israel candidate wins, they love to point out that, you know, this proves that the squad is an extreme minority within the Democratic Party, and the support for conditioning aid is very low. It's only, you know, Bernie Sanders, nobody else. But like I said, if we look at the polling on these issues, it's the exact opposite. Like their position is the position that is the minority, that is not in the mainstream of Democratic voters. And I think on some level, they know that. And that is why you see so much anxiety about things like BDS. You see so much anxiety about more politicians talking about conditioning aid to Israel, because they know the writing is on the wall when it comes to this stuff. And, you know, it's happening at a very, you know, slow pace, and especially so slow pace in Washington, as expected. But it is shifting, which is, you know, this is why we call the newsletter that we do The Shift, because it's kind of this idea that, you know, slowly things are moving in a different direction. So, like a lot of these groups that have sprouted up, and a lot of kind of these, their attempts to kind of clamp down on this stuff, is in reaction to the fact that it's doing so well, is in reaction to the fact that we're seeing big wins. You know, people like the BDS fail hashtag, like this, all this kind of stuff about how BDS has never done anything and has no impact. Yeah. But yet there's all these laws in the states now to effectively criminalize BDS. So, you know, if BDS was a nothing organization with a few people that had no impact on the country, then there wouldn't be this, you know, this desire or this need to pass laws to criminalize it. I think on some level they feel threatened by it. Not just here,
but if it wasn't that big a deal, you wouldn't see the Israeli government and, in fact, the Israeli military putting the kind of resources into it that they're doing. Yeah,
absolutely true. And you know that app that you know we've covered at the site, which kind of encourages people to, you know, congratulate Madonna for playing Tel Aviv or whatever. It didn't kind of like bolster these anti-BDS talking points on the internet is partially funded by the Israeli government. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about, you know, Russia potential influence in our elections, or, you know, now, you know, I saw a Newsweek story yesterday that was basically like, you know, China, a picture of China's leader, like at a laptop, basically implying like, you know, China's going to control our country in some way. And yet, you know, like there's an app partially funded by a foreign country that's, you know, encouraging people to to vote a certain way or to believe certain things, and it doesn't really get covered in the mainstream media. So, yeah.
Yeah. Any last thoughts on what's going to happen? I mean, you're pretty solid that Biden is going to win. I'm less solid.
I don't know for sure. Yeah.
I think Biden is going to easily get more votes. You know, Hillary Clinton got more votes. I mean, in terms of, you know,
right.
if an election is a poll of who the voters in the country want to be their leader, Hillary Clinton won. I think Joe Biden is going to win, mm-hmm. but I'm not so sure.
I think, I think I said something like this in the newsletter, but I think, you know, Biden will win, but whether he becomes president is a different story. You know,
right.
There's a lot of stuff that you can read this week about voter suppression or the courts doing certain things or, you know, these horrifying scenarios involving Pennsylvania going to Trump that could potentially throw things off. So I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. But I do think one thing I do worry about with Trump too, that I would just mention, and this kind of goes beyond politics, is I think there's a belief that when things get really bad, people get more tuned in, and it creates kind of like rebellions. And I think if you look at history, that's not always true. I think people can get dejected to the point where they kind of don't believe that fighting back is really worth it. And I think there's a narrative that kind of like, you know, during the Great Depression, things got so bad that all of a sudden then there was this labor activism that led to the New Deal. But if you look at it, when things were really, really bad at the beginning, there wasn't really that. It wasn't until things kind of turned the corner a little that, you know, people felt like they had that forum. So I do, insofar as Trump has mobilized people and turned people into activists and maybe even brought some people to our side, I do worry about the people who kind of aren't in it for the long haul, kind of revving them up by doing the, you know, don't mourn, organize thing again. I don't know. I do worry about that. I do worry about fatigue on top of, you know, this, you know, terrible pandemic and people's mental health already being shot for 1,000 reasons. That is kind of something to worry. If the Republicans do steal it, I am interested to see, you know, what happens in terms of activism against Trump if we do see it ramp up, because there's a part of me that fears it'll actually begin to lessen. But yeah, it's my grim thought to close on.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I mean, if people watching are interested in what and are worried, you know, what should you do if that happens? I would say look to the movement organizations, JVP, if not now, inside the Palestine Solidarity Movement space, other groups like Sunrise Movement, Justice Dems, of course, from an electoral perspective, Dream Defenders is another one to look to. They're all thinking about and planning and organizing what we should do the day after if there's an attempt to just outright steal the election and impose, you know, continued minority rule on us. So look to that. Oh, mm-hmm. Michael, this has been great. Thank you so much. If people are watching and they're interested in more of what Michael is doing, check him out at our website, mondaweiss.net. And if you go to the URL there on your screen, you can subscribe to the newsletter. It comes out every Thursday with all kinds of good information about what's going on around the country. And thanks so much, Michael. We'll check back in with you after the election, probably.
Sure. Thanks,
Dave. Once we're in the Biden utopia that has saved us all and restored the country to whatever, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye.